Welcome back. You're watching Stockwatch with me, Zinati Guma. Tackling your stock-related questions this evening are Jean-Pierre Verster from Protea Capital Management and Trikas Kombring from Capicroft. Don't forget to send those questions via SMS to 41392 or email stockwatch@bdtv.co.za or tweet us at BusinessDayTV using the hashtag Stockwatch. Thanks so much for your time, gentlemen. I'm surprised that you're still available because so many people are already going on leave. So just as the end of the year approaches, what are some of the big catalysts for the markets that you have your eye on, starting with you, JP?
Yes, so if I think about catalysts, the one big question that I think the market is grappling with is where is the Fed funds rate going to settle at, the long-term rate? If you look at the moment, it looks like maybe about 4%. The expectations have come down just in the last few weeks to slightly lower than 4%. So I think that'll be a key catalyst if people get a sense that we have reached the top of the rising interest rate cycle in the US. And then I think the other catalyst is what's going to happen with energy markets globally.
Yeah.
We've seen energy markets spike, and there are two schools thinking about what might happen next, that it will stay high because supply is throttled. And people want to transition to green energy, but they haven't really invested enough to do that. Or we'll see lower energy prices because, you know, what comes up must come down in commodity markets.
Yeah.
So I would say interest rates and energy markets. Those are two key catalysts for 2023. Yeah.
Talking about interest rates, because for the last few days, we've kind of seen the negative sentiment in the markets, of course, spooked by the robust economic data that keeps on coming out of the US. Yesterday, it was the PMI on the services sector, still signaling that that sector is still quite strong. And of course, this came on the heels of the US non-farm payrolls that were quite strong on Friday. And I'm wondering, as the markets are so spooked, why there's still such a big pricing of a 50 basis point hike instead of 75, Trikas?
Well, we're still going in the, let's call it, the wrong direction. You know, from a monetary perspective, it's the right direction. Inflation is still a problem. Even though I do think that the second derivative of inflation, you know, the rate of change of inflation is definitely moderating for a lot of categories. And we might see more of that. CPI's coming out, US CPI's coming out next week, Tuesday. Later, I think this week, Friday, it will be US PPI. But back to your point about the data. The data, even though some of it might be lagging, is still quite strong. You know, it still doesn't give the doves, if there are any out there within the Federal Reserve, anything to talk about. And I think the question is, to add to JP's interest rates question, though, you know, not necessarily where does it settle, but when does the economic data start turning bad? And, you know, how bad does it get? And how far can, you know, the Fed and central bank globally course correct without causing an inflation problem? You know, it's all difficult questions. I haven't got the answers, but it's something that you must consider within the construction of your portfolio, obviously.
All right. Well, it seems that the third quarter GDP numbers for South Africa couldn't have come at a better time for Cyril Ramaphosa. Of course, even though a lot of, you know, people really think that he is the most credible person to be at the head of the ANC, there has been pushback that, you know what, even though he is seen as probably the most credible person, the economy has still been in the doldrums under his leadership. So we did have that GDP coming in better than expected. JP, how do you feel about those numbers?
Yeah, it came out above expectations, but I mean, it's quite noisy on a quarter-to-quarter basis. And we're now talking about the third quarter, so to the end of September, while we're already in December. So, you know, a lot has happened since the end of September, and we need to wait another 3 months before we get the Q4 numbers.
Yeah.
So I don't put a lot of emphasis on quarterly GDP numbers.
Okay.
Because of the noise and the fact that there's such a big lag when it comes out. But to your point, the economy has been under strain, and it's because of Eskom, because of a lot of issues, and because still of, let's call it, a structural hangover of corruption that has caused so much damage to our country that it's taking a long time to slowly but surely address and hopefully correct. Look, at least the GDP number was positive. Let's look at the silver lining and let's hope for a few more quarters of positive numbers coming.
All right. Drukus, on your side, I mean, it was quite a big surprise. 0.6% growth expected by economists, 0.4% expected by the South African Reserve Bank, and then you get to the actual print coming in at 1.6%. Would you still say that it doesn't signal that South Africa, the South African economy has turned a corner? I mean, maybe also echoing what JP's saying that you'd rather wait for the yearly figure.
No, so most of the recovery that we've seen in the last year or so has been on the back of higher commodity prices, higher commodity volumes. Some of that has thankfully recovered in the third quarter because Transnet is starting to sort out a bit of issues and some of the ports have opened up. In the second quarter, you still have floods down in Durban, etc. So a lot of it is pent-up exports. And the exports drove together with mining and manufacturing on a sector level, drove a lot of that figure. If you go into capital formation, the whole GDP figure driven by exports mainly and by manufacturing and the mining is now higher than it was in 2019. We've recovered, our COVID blues. Household consumption expenditure and more importantly, gross fixed capital formation is still very subdued. And that points to, the local economy. So all those mining profits and a bit of manufacturing profits they're using that to consolidate, the businesses and they're not really reinvesting that back into the economy.
All right. So, although we are seeing green shoots, of course, the domestic demand is still quite weak. Talking about turning a corner, there's a question here on EOH. Do you think the company has turned the corner? JP.
I think operationally it's turned the corner. I think the management team there deserve a medal for what they've done. The only thing that hasn't turned the corner is the balance sheet, and we know that they've announced that their bankers are forcing them to do a rights issue, which unfortunately is going to be highly dilutive. And we're still waiting for the price, but indications are that the number of shares outstanding is going to more than double. So that's going to dilute current shareholders. And then it's all about post the rights issue, if they fix the balance sheet and the legacy debt, what they can do with this business now going forward. It's a much smaller business because they needed to sell a lot of profitable divisions to address the debt and survive. But I do think they've turned the corner. The question is about the valuation. And I would hope that post the rights issue, depending on the price, that could put a floor on the price, and then we can see a nice recovery in the share price, which follows the operational recovery of the EOH.
Okay, so Drukus, would you say that then if you believe in the EOH story and that they have indeed turned a corner, because that rights issue to settle the debt is going to be dilutive to current shareholders, then the better time to go in would be after that rights issue?
Yeah, well, you can't do anything unless I know a price. Each and every asset, then you can't ever ask me about any asset without knowing the price. So, unless I know the rights issue terms, it's impossible to say. But I do think, as JP said, they've stabilized the business. I don't know what their growth prospects are, but, if enough shareholders, just shunned this one after the rights issue and that corrected the balance sheet, there might be opportunity. There usually is.
All right. Talking about opportunity, what would be the best pick be between Absa or Standard Bank in a portfolio for medium term? Also, the prospects for good dividends and growth over the medium term period. Of course, we know that the financials were quite beaten down last week, but we are seeing a nice recovery even today. As the JSE was in the red, we did see the financials in the green. So, JP, I guess it's no question as to whether there is value in the banking sector, but between Absa and Standard Bank?
Yeah, it's a bit of a much of a muchness between the two. They both have significant African operations as well, and some African countries are going through a tough time at the moment. If I think of Nigeria, for instance, even though the oil price is high, there's all kinds of structural issues and still problems with the Naira and repatriating funds out of Nigeria. And even in East Africa, things aren't going that great. If you look at what's happening in some of the geographies there, even Egypt, I know they don't have material operations there, it has some trouble. So between the two, it's the same investment case. That is that you have a very profitable, but probably low growth bank in South Africa, more growth coming from Africa, but at higher risk. And then it means if you look at the current valuation of both these banks, I would say it's probably fair. And a lot would be driven by the GDP growth in not only South Africa, but the rest of Africa, and sidestepping some of those risks that are normally associated with commodity-dependent economies. And then these banks could do reasonably well. But the big recovery from really depressed levels happened between, let's say, March, April 2020, the COVID depth, to quite recently. From now on, it would probably be more moderated growth.
Atrikas, would you look at these two with the same lens, or are there significant differences that you'd keep in mind?
Now, we bought smallish amounts a while ago, offered a bit of value, but at these levels, you know, they're not really cheap. Banks internationally are trading at sub-10 price earnings ratios. You've got a lot of international banks, and I'm not even mentioning European banks that are, you know, got toxic balance sheets. So you've got US banks and UK banks trading at one price to book, you know, one times book value, which is, you know, they used to trade at 2.5 times average before the global financial crisis. So if you do think there's going to be a global recovery in interest rate margins, because that's typically what happens when interest rates rise, I do think there's more upside offshore. And I do think, secondly, that, you know, just from optically, from a valuation perspective, you know, the multiples just look the same as they do locally. But I do think there's more upside offshore if interest rates margins can, you know, if you take a five-year view and interest rate margins opens up, you know, then typically interest rate income might double from these levels. It's possible.
Just looking at the JSE, the moves were quite, they weren't really the big movements that we're used to seeing. But I did notice that some sectors or some counters actually did have big movements, not as big as Marian Roberts yesterday. So you had Thungela and Glencore down, I think, over 2%, almost 3%. And then you had the retailers up about 3-4%. So just pick one, JP, and maybe is there anything significant that did move any of those today?
Yeah, so I'll touch on the coal market and Glencore in particular. Glencore had a update today where they gave their forecasts of their production numbers for their commodities, including coal. And those numbers were a bit disappointing. In the next 3 years or so, the volume of metals that they produce is going to be roughly flat. And the market was a bit disappointed by that. And they also indicated what their free cash flow yield was using current spot prices for the commodities that they produce. And that was also a bit lower than what the market was hoping for. It is being driven by coal at the moment. So coal is the big swing factor. And if you think about the type of free cash flow yield that Glencore is trading at, call it 15, 16%, that sounds very attractive. But then you look at a single coal commodity producer like Thungela, and it's just by double that. So my preference is still for Thungela, and the little bit of lower share price today, I would say, is an opportunity to maybe switch some Glencore, if you have some of that, into Thungela, which I believe that shows more value.
Retailers, on the other hand, quite big movements there, robust, about 3%, 4% gains there. I think the last ones that I saw were Truworths, ShopRite. Drikas, anything significant that has moved those today?
I didn't see anything, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
No, nothing. I don't know if one of the retailers reported and there was a bit of a sympathy rally. I didn't see anything.
Yeah. Could it maybe not be GDP?
Could be GDP, but once again, then they should do better homework. You know, consumption expenditure wasn't up by that much.
Yeah, okay. All right. I see. But a lot of us really just look at the headline number and we don't really drill down
Sure.
into the numbers. Yeah.
Yeah, as do the algos on some of these names. So you'll typically see the if the large caps move without the medium and small caps, it's typically a lot of day traders and algos that only moves on the headline, you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, there's another headline today, and I actually have two questions on that. It's about nutritional holdings. I'm not sure if you guys actually look at it, but it's listing on the JSE will be removed. For existing shareholders, does this mean your capital goes down the drain, or you can sell out of the investment when the company is private? And yeah, the other one, what are the implications for existing shareholders? So that company's really been challenged for a long time. I think when you look at their division that sells the powdered milk to schools and prisons, there's challenges there. It's not really making any profit. And then you look at the cannabis side, that's not really operational. JP, do you have any insights on that?
Yeah, I would just say in general that when a company delists without a buyout of all the shareholders, it becomes very tricky. You can technically still trade the shares, but it's not traded on an exchange. So you don't know where to find a buyer for the shares you want to sell. The best way is to contact the company directly, the company secretary, or the transfer secretaries that handles the transfer of ownership for a public company. So you can still trade the shares even though it's not listed, but it's very difficult, and you need to indeed find someone for the other side of the transaction, and then you need to negotiate with them a price that they would be willing at to do a transaction. So it's very tedious, and normally it does mean that you're not going to be able to transact anywhere close to the last price at which that company was traded at on the JSE.
Yeah, all right. Well, thank you for that, JP. There's a question, actually, two questions on Zeda with an A and not an ER. It says, well, one question actually. Zeda will be listed on the JSE on the 13th of December. Any news on this company and its prospects going forward? Do you expect extreme volatility on the share price on the day? And for a couple of days thereafter, it has been valued at 4.5 billion rand. Opinions on this valuation? Of course, that separate listing from Barloworld. Trikas?
Yeah, well, at that price, it's about 15 rand price if I ran the numbers right. It gets to a high single digit PE, more or less, which is cheap. It's a dividend yield of about 5%. It should support about a dividend yield of 5%, and that's more or less in line with a CMH, which I regard as a great operator. So I don't see it as very cheap at that price. If it dips below that, we'll be looking to acquire some. But once again, if you can't really know the price until it hits the JSE. Normally, what happens with spin-offs or unbundlings, as we call them here, is a lot of people from the parent company just sells out. They have no interest in holding that single share. It's usually a small part of their holdings, and it's just doesn't move the needle for them, so they indiscriminately sell it. And hopefully for our smaller operators, they do just that, and then we'll be looking to pick up the shares. But at 15 rand, it's not extremely cheap. That's yeah, but it's certainly something worth looking at.
All right. So Trigger saying that doesn't look particularly cheap. Maybe he'd get in at a lower price. Yeah. So the second question, with the Barloworld unbundling, will it be worth it to hold Zeda shares? JP?
Yeah, it all depends on the price at which the Zeda shares trade when they are listed on the 13th. My views are broadly similar to Dricus. I would add to that by saying that the last, say, 18 months to 2 years have been exceptional years for car rental businesses. And Zeda, with its Avis Budget division, has made a lot of money through that. So I would caution about the growth prospects of Zeda, and therefore a lower multiple is justified. And one would need to wait for the price at which the first buyers and sellers transact on the 13th. It will probably be a bit volatile on the first day. And then if it, to use very broad round numbers, if it trades at 20 Rand per share, you probably want to sell all your Zedar shares. And if it trades at 10 Rand a share, you'd probably consider buying more Zedar shares.
All right. Marion Roberts, that was still down today after that plunge we saw yesterday of more than 20%. Today, still down about 10%. Of course, the jitters just aren't ending on that counter. It's had actually had quite a horrible time this year. And we've had ups and downs on announcements of acquisitions and disposals. And of course, the latest one being now the fallout or fall through of the acquisition of Clough by WeBuild in Italy. Drikus, what will you be waiting to hear from Marion Roberts going forward, considering that they had already rejigged their strategy and Clough was basically seen as part of their growth strategy going forward?
I've luckily avoided this one for so long. I've almost forgotten about its listing. Maybe Jean-Pierre, you can add something about it. I've completely ignored them in the recent past.
Yeah. All right. JP, have you been looking at them?
Also not recently for good reason. I mean, it's actually fascinating. Marion Roberts has got a very long and proud history of being a public company. And it just shows how difficult the construction industry is. And when I say construction, I include big projects in that. And all the big construction companies except for WBHO in South Africa have almost hit the wall. And internationally, the moment these companies tried to diversify, they also ran into trouble. WBHO ran into big trouble in Australia, and now Marion Roberts even bigger trouble by putting Clough in administration. So it is a very sad state of affairs. And I think the lesson we can take out of this is that the quality of a business ultimately decides what one's return will be. And if you buy businesses with questionable business models, which I would add construction as being part of that, it almost doesn't matter how cheap you can get the shares. You run the risk that the share goes to zero. And I would say that Marion Roberts runs that risk because after Clough being put in administration and selling Bombela, there's not much left. They have the cementation business still left in Australia, but buyer beware when it comes to construction businesses.
Yeah, right. A very interesting one that we will be looking out for there. Of course, it will be interesting as to how they sell the business going forward to shareholders. Right, let's get to your stock picks for today, gentlemen. Drikus, what would it be?
Styriza PLC. They came out with results recently. I think I pitched the stock a few months ago. Can't remember. But I think it's still a good buy at these levels. It's sitting at a forward price to book below of EV to EBITDA below 2. There's a lot of net cash on the balance sheet. A lot of that will be used for the Karoo project, which is also a PGM project. And obviously nobody likes PGM at the moment because it's, you know, we're all going to use electric vehicles over the next few years. I don't completely buy into that. I do think it's going to take longer than that. And in the meantime, I do actually think PGM demand will go higher as global auto demand keeps growing. I think you're being adequately compensated for any risk to that thesis, at least at these levels.
All right. And on your side, JP, what are you hanging your hat on today?
My stock pick is Kering. It's a French luxury goods company, spelled K-E-R-I-N-G. The word Kering actually comes from the word in Brittany, which is a region of France with its own language, where the word care means home. And it was the home of the family that controls Kering as a listed business. It's one of the largest luxury goods businesses in the world, and it owns Gucci and Yves Saint Laurent. So Gucci is the real powerhouse. A lot of people would give many paychecks to get a Gucci handbag. We spoke earlier about valuations and quality of business models. I would say that luxury goods is one of the best business models out there. And for the last few years, China has been under pressure with their COVID lockdowns. It looks like some of those lockdowns are being lifted. And that means that luxury goods businesses, including Kering with their Gucci brand, will probably do quite well. So that's my stock pick for the long term.
Kering. All right. Thank you for that. I'll stop saying YSL to get out of saying Yves Saint Laurent. At least now I know how to pronounce it. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for your time. My guests, Jean-Pierre Verster from Protea Capital Management and Trikas Komring from Campycraft. Julieta is back with Stockwatch tomorrow night. Have a good evening. It's